Thank you guys very much. I'm Evan, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here. I want to thank Andrea for calling me to come down and speak. I want to thank CJ for giving my phone number to Andrea. And I don't know how CJ got it. I would never, ever. I'm kidding. I love you, CJ. I'm where you're sitting here. We've known each other for, quite a while, I guess. It's so funny how time passes in this program, you know? It's like when you talked about time, time's important. It's important if you don't have it, you know? And after a while, it just sort of, you know, it's just today. And then pretty soon you're old, you know? And there's a lot more things to do. And God, life gets so full. It's just remarkable. I mean, I look at my day, and it's just how I take on things today. Like I would never, when I drank, I would never get in the car and drive this far for somebody else. Or for me, you know, unless there was like, that was the closest cocktail, you know, then I'd walk, you know. But I would never, you know, and I look at the day, it was no big deal. It was like, oh, hey, look, bang, let's go, you know, and in the shower. I showered today, which is, who had time for that before? And the map, I got to tell you, your map, you might want to revise it, because it's sort of an aerial view. Yeah, so it's like in scale if you're like in a plane, you know? So it looks really close to the marina, and I had to violate some laws getting here. Not many. No, but thanks. It wasn't that bad. It's just where it says, like, La Paz and the freeway, and then La Paz looks like a block, and that's, like, more than a block. So I cut it so close, though. God, just the idea of being able to show up. It's been a great day, you know, too. I mean, I was on the internet today. I got a computer, and finally got a computer and got on the internet. Those of you who aren't on the computer, don't worry about it or don't have it on the internet. But it is pretty cool. I got on it, and there was an AA meeting. There's a place called Staying Cyber. And they have meetings going all the time. And it was cool to log on there and see what was going on. And there was a woman on there. There was a woman on there from, like, New Jersey or someplace. And she said, I'm in my fourth day, and I'm really freaking out because day five is supposed to be the hardest. And it was like, I'm just sitting alone with a computer going, oh, my God. You know, that compassion, that, oh, honey, 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 you know, and that reach. It's like, it's very cool how AA is so available now. And the idea that I even, why I'm allowed on a computer is bizarre anyway. But I'm a blackout drinker. I'm a guy who drank vodka till he fell down. I love to blackout. Blacking out's my favorite thing because I'm still at the party. I just don't have to actually play. I don't have to talk, I don't have to interact with you, you know. Because I love you, I'm just scared to death of you. And it's really easy for me to be blacked out. And even tonight I was very nervous. This meeting's great when it has a lot of energy, and it's like way nervous to come in that door and see that mirror and go, God, look at the size of this meeting. But then you notice yourself and you go, oh, well, there's a guy kind of like me. But I'm not, for the people that are new, that this is new to you in AA, I say that AA is new to you. I don't like to refer to people as newcomers. I remember when I came in, people said, you know, newcomers. And I was like, hey, I'm not newcomer to nothing, man. You know where I've been, you know. I have seen a lot, you know. And so I always sort of say to people, if this is new to you, no, I'm not an authority in AA. I'm just giving my story and what happened to me and my take on it, which might not really be the take you want. But the real authority is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the smaller version, but that's the authority. And get that book if you have any questions. If you don't like what I'm saying, that's okay too. You know, you aren't unique. That's why I always identify as an Al-Anon, too. God bless Al-Anon. The Al-Anons that are here, I always raise my hand. My first sponsor made me go to Al-Anon. I said, what the hell for? He said, well, somebody bought you those drinks. So I went, you know, because I have trouble. I have a lot of relationships with a lot of alcoholics. And what I learned in Al-Anon, this is one of the coolest things, because it's scary to stand up and speak. It's scary to stand up and share and bare your soul, you know. And what's scary about it is the fact that you're judging me, you know. Maybe you're judging me, you know. And what I learned in Al-Anon is that if you are judging me, you have work to do on your program. And it's my job to help you bottom out on that behavior. Hi. Why two? Is somebody else coming? Thanks very much. He looks thirsty. Give him two. So I love Al-Anon. I love every program that has the 12 steps. All the 12 steps that AA started out to be AA and alcohol, they took them and they apply them to a lot of things now. And I love every program where the 12 steps are involved. I really do. I love applying them. It's saved my life. You guys let me come into these rooms and you gave me these steps. Here. You can use them. You can apply them anywhere. And it's, man, I love all of it. I love all of it. And it's why I'm here today. Because I have no living skills, man. When I came to you guys, I had the software I had installed was not actually up to driving any hardware, you know. And I knew you were, you know, judging me. You know, I wanted to be your friend. You know, whoever was in the room was my higher power, you know. And which in a room this size with this many people means for a busy list of commandments, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. How it started was, I don't think I was born, I think I was born alcoholic. I don't think I learned it, or I can't blame my parents. I can't blame anyone. I know my life is a strange sort of story, the way it sort of happened. I was kidnapped by my father when I was two from my mother in Glendale, and we just drove until he ran out of money, which wasn't a lot of money, so we wound up in Utah. And not a lot of gas money. And I never knew her, really. She tried to kidnap me back at one point, and I had visitation with her when I was like, I don't know, three or four. And but Dad, you know, he tried to marry his wife from before that, and she came out for a while, and then that didn't work, and then what happened is he wound up marrying a lot of women and taking me with him. The problem was he wouldn't end one relationship before he started the next one. And that generated some resentment. But he took me with him, and I didn't know why, you know, but all I knew was he's the king, you know. He's the guy with the wallet, and so whatever he said went, and he and I were very close. We finally married into a family, and wound up in North Idaho, where I grew up, a little mining town, Kellogg, Idaho, and in this family with all, you know, two older brothers, an older sister, and normal people, and they were great, you know, and it was just a tiny little town, and I remember asking my dad at one point, though. I mean, my belief system was that, because since my mom, I knew my mom had left, and I asked my dad, "Why? Where's mom?" And he said, "Well, she just didn't take care of you." And then I was 5 or 6 or something. I said, "Ah, well, okay. I wonder why. It must be something I did, you know, because you take it on as a kid." So my belief system is I don't deserve a mother's love, you know. My other belief system when I came to you, I asked Dad once, we used to walk to church. He thought he was Andy Griffith. We'd go to church on Sunday. And I remember asking him one day after Sunday school, because I was very confused, "Dad, what is it all about? You know, who is God exactly, and what is it we're shooting for here?" And and he said to me, "Geez, pal, I really couldn't tell you." That was his answer. And I was like, I'm like 6 or 7 years old, and I'm like, couldn't tell me, you know. And I know he was trying to give me just freedom of religious choice. But man, I'm looking for answers, you know, and you've got the money, for crying out loud, and if you don't know what's happening, we are, you know. If you don't know, apparently no one knows, so we have no clue, and it doesn't matter, you know. I just don't deserve a woman's love. There we go. Get to it, you know. And that's, yeah, I grew up. I remember, you know, everything sort of confirmed those beliefs growing up. You know, from then on till I got to you guys, everything just sort of was a backup for those two beliefs. In the 7th grade, you know, I asked Nancy Waltman to the dance, and I'd never been to a dance, and we held hands in the gym, and it was sweaty, and we lived in this little, the same neighborhood, and, you know, we never kissed or nothing. It was just, didn't even dance, you know. It was like, I'm with a girl, you know, and walked her home after the dance, you know, walked her home, got to her house, and I kissed her on the mouth outside her house, and she screamed at the top of her lungs. And I started smoking Marlboros like the next day or so. Because I realized, you know, he doesn't need a woman. And you got your horse and your hat and you're on kind of an outlaw. Because women will scream when you kiss them. And I decided to become a rebel then, and started smoking cigarettes, and decided to go to a party with Terry Pitano. We snuck out of the house, our respective houses, and you know, it was at 6:30 at night. Ooh, I'm beat. And you go to bed, and <laughs> 6:40, you're like, you know. And we went to a party. His brothers were in college, and they were having some frat party, and I just drank everything they had, and they brought me home in a truck and tried to sneak me back in. That was what was funny, because I had no motor skills, you know. It was like, and they wound up, it was a room in the basement. They ended up dropping me on my head on the linoleum. And the big clunk, and Dad wakes up. "What's that clunk?" And comes down. That was my first drinking, you know. And I loved it. I loved blacking out. High school parties, I loved them. It's funny, to go back, I look at my high school yearbook. My mom has it up in, she's up in Tacoma now. I went through it over the holidays. I looked at it. Everything on there says, you know, "You're a nice guy, but you drink too much." "I remember you in the trunk of Terry's car." I don't remember any of that, man. I remember you in the tub at Christie's party. I wound up going to college, and I don't know how I got into college. I don't think you needed a lot to go to college in Idaho. You know, I think you needed a truck. And I had no idea what I was doing there. It was just culture shock, you know. It was like I went from a town of 5,000 people to a college campus with 16,000 kids. And my head just exploded in low self-esteem. And I'd done drugs in high school. I was never big on drugs, except I wanted to be your friend, so I had to do them. They're a part of my story. I had to do what you guys had just so I could be your pal, you know. And I didn't like them. I didn't like to smoke marijuana because I got more scared. And I had to drink more to black out, you know, because that's why blackouts are so great, you know, and I'm so terrified, and not to mention the LSD. I mean, God, aw. There's no blacking out. You are up, man. It was just more terror, you know. And I remember that feeling every time being at a party or being in, you know, even in my dorm room in college, my roommate in college, and he'd go, ah, we're going to eat hashish. And I'd like, ah, oh. Just intense anxiety, you know. Why can't we just drink, you know? I was very scared, you know. Everything in my life was dictated by fear. You know, I went to the campus counselors because I didn't know. Everybody knew what they wanted to do. I had no idea. They said, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. And they said, well, what are you good at? You know, I said, let me think about it, you know. And I went home because I like to obsess on myself, you know, and think. And I got alone and thought. And what I realized is I'm a really good liar, you know. I got a good line of bullshit, man. And the way I got it, you know, the way I got it was trying to impress you, you know, because you're my higher power and I don't want you seeing who I really am. And so I learned to have a good line of bullshit. And they said, well, you should try theater. And so I did. And I guess, I don't know why theater and not law. That's a joke. You know, it's a joke. I think because I didn't have the IQ to be in law. He's not a sharp kid. Send him to the theater. He's fun to watch. And so that's what I wound up doing. And you could drink there, you know. And they sort of cleaned me up a bit, you know, brushed off the, made the party classy. And I went to college and studied theater, and I had a lot of trouble dealing with the other people. You know, that's always been my problem, fear of other people. And I got out of college and knew that just there's too much trouble working with other people and directors and producers and other actors. And I really got to do a one-man show of some sort. And I started doing that stand-up comedy in the clubs because that's where, you know, that was starting to get big now, and you could drink, they could pay in drinks, and that's what I started doing. I wound up, and I really didn't drink alcoholically then either, you know. I was very intent on doing that right and doing it well. I wanted to do my best because I'm out on the world and on my own now, and I dated a couple girls in college, so I knew something about that too, you know. How to trick them so they don't scream, you know. You know, you sort of make them look over here and kiss them and they don't scream, you know. And I trick girls into being my girlfriend. I wound up living in San Francisco, and I started drinking a lot in San Francisco. I started making a living doing the stand-up there. And making a living. I started making enough money to support myself. However, that's not what happened. I spent the money on partying, you know. I never did support myself. out there. I never have until I got to you guys. It was always, who can I borrow money from? You know? So when I got in the real world, it's like, who could I borrow money from and who will go to bed with me? Those were my two main concerns. I need a higher power with cash and I need a mom. And I was constantly scanning every room, and those were my two goals. And I wanted to sleep with you or get your money. And I didn't know that at the time. It's in retrospect, I look back and go, wow, not a pretty character, you know? And in fact, in San Francisco, that's how I used to meet girls. There was a bar, I lived at, in Noe Valley in San Francisco, a little neighborhood. There was a neighborhood bar called Bradley's, and it was a, owned by these gay guys. And during the day, it was just a commuter bar on the N. Judah train line, you know? So everybody was in there, you know, during the days and early afternoons. At night, then the gay guys would come in. And it was just across the street from my apartment, so I'd hang out at Bradley's, you know? And all day, drink all day, and because I had shows at night, you know, and then I'd come back from shows, and it'd be all the guys, you know? And they'd go, hey, and they go, hey, and they go, you know, have a drink. And, are you gay? And I go, well, I don't think so. And okay, we'll have a drink anyway, you know, and I'd be sitting there, and every once in a while a woman would come, you know, late from work off the train, and she'd straggle in and go, I think I'll have a drink, and she'd straggle in the bar, and the guys would just go, well, he's down there. It was kind of like gill netting, you know, and that's how I'd meet girls, you know. It's kismet. It's fate. We both came into this bar. Who knew? And I loved Bradley's, man. It was my favorite bar. It was just home, you know. You find a place you feel comfortable, and I'd isolate. And I had a woman I lived with who loved me, and I drank her out of the house. And it's like you were saying, you know, if the relationship goes, she said, you know, I'm going to move out if you keep drinking. And I said, well, I'll help you find a place, you know. I'm really worried about you. And, and I met another girl in the bar, which was perfect. She was an Irish Catholic mental health nurse. And boy, there's nothing better for taking care of a rebel. I wasn't a drunk, I just needed more stew. I loved her so much, and I drank, I started hitting detoxes, you know. It just started becoming apparent that I couldn't function. It got to a point where I couldn't do shows. I couldn't, I'd show up for a performance and the shakes would be there. And I'm like, what's that? And I can't talk and I'm sick to my stomach. Oh, well, you better drink again. Well, I can't, because then I'll be too drunk to do the show. Well, you just can't do the show. Why don't you just tell them? And then pretty soon, well, you detox. Oh, and I remember my first detox, you know, and trying to be cool in my first detox. There's no. Have you done that? You go in, and it's like everybody's, they're just there. It's like you're kind of like, okay, what's the scene, man? There is no scene, man. Nobody's identified my first detox. I remember because the first hallucinations I saw a mariachi band made up of cats. I swear, as clear as day, man. And they were good and loud. And I didn't know if it was part of the place. Are they detoxing too? And the terror upon realizing that probably no one else notices the band. No one else is moving to the beat. And I went through a series of detoxes and treatment, and I was brought to you guys my first times there after those detoxes, and Redwood City was my first speaker meeting, Redwood City, California, and I got together for like 6 months in a just white knuckling it and couldn't do it. I'd do the first half of the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol. And then I'd go out and just try and fix it all. That was my program, man. And I came to you and I was just, man, I just, and I went, the last detox I was, I knew about you guys, I just could not grab it, man. It was like a dog on tiles, you know. It was like I had no traction. It was just, we're powerless, woohoo! And let's fix it, man, and let's get famous and get some cash and everybody get a mom, you know. And, I couldn't get relieved of the obsession to drink. And my last detox was in San Rafael, California. It was May in 1986. And I was in this detox. It was a little residential house. And it was like maybe 3 bedrooms upstairs. And just a house in the front porch was walled off, and it was an office for checking in. It had a yard. Really nice. And I checked in, and I don't remember checking in. Alicia checked me in, my Irish Catholic mental health nurse. She tried detoxing me with Xanax, and that didn't help. So I wound up getting a medical, I don't know, something happened, and I wound up in there. Anyway, I was at wit's end, man. I haven't laughed in a long time. I don't know about you guys. It's fun to laugh at now, but I hadn't laughed in a long time. When I came to you guys, man, I was bummed that I couldn't drink like I wanted to drink. I was really seriously distressed. My family had said, don't come home anymore. We don't want to, just don't come home anymore until you have like 6 months sober or something. You have a problem. I mean, I knew I was alcoholic. My family quit coming. My friends didn't want to see me anymore. You know, the excuse of, well, I've had a little to drink was no longer cute. You know, it's not quaint at 6 a.m. I'd lost a lot of people, and I didn't have any humor in my life. I wasn't laughing at all. And I was feeling really distressed that I couldn't get to a funny place. I couldn't see what was funny anymore. It was just tragic, you know. And the guys at Bradley's had said, really, don't come back. You're too young. You're 29 years old, and you're here with these guys that are total wet brains. We don't want to see that. I was like, what do you mean? You know how much money I give you? And they're like, and the owner, Bill, he says, I don't care, really. I don't care how much money you bring, we really don't want to see it. So I was at wit's end, man. And I'd been in, I don't know, 5 or 6 detoxes, been to you guys, it wasn't working. No one would hire me to work. People would hear in Detroit, I'd have a booking 6 or 8 months in advance in Detroit. They'd hear I drank and cancel it. 6 months in advance. They go, oh, he slipped. Well, we'll rebook. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. So I'm in my last detox, and I'm shaking it out. I'm really bad news, man. I'm suicidal. I'm like, I want to drink or I want to die. I can't believe it, that I got to... I'm not quitting anymore. I know quitting is quitting, and I'm not quitting. I know I'm not quitting. It just ain't happening. It's a slick tire there, you know? It ain't happening. And I want to die. I'm not laughing. This ain't fun. I don't see any humor in this at all. And I remember saying to God, if there is a God, because I was seriously contemplating suicide in that detox when I came to from that blackout and was checked in, I wanted to kill myself. And all I had were a pair of fingernail clippers. And this was serious. I was deadly serious about not wanting to take the time to kill myself with those. And I was down in the kitchen and having hot tea, you know, like day two, and you're bent over in the stomach and the shakes. And there's a couple other homeless guys, 4 or 5 guys, and they're shuffling around. They made spaghetti or something, and it was like tea and honey. And you look through the kitchen and you see some guy checking in. There was a guy checking into the detox. He had a 3-piece suit on. And this guy was coiffed. He was like 6'4 or something, man. And he was coming in. He looked great. And it was like, the other guys, he came in, he checked in, he came in the kitchen, and the other guys were like, ugh, and ran off. And I just sort of stunned, sat down. It was like, I don't care, man. I'm honey, you know. And he sat down at the table. He said, how's it going? And I said, not good. How's it going with you? And he said, not good. And he started talking. He said he had 7 or 8 years sober in AA. And he bought his 7-year-old kid a bicycle for his birthday, and the next day his kid was killed on that bike. And this had just happened, and he went to a bar when that happened. He went to a bar and he had a drink. He had one drink. And he drank it. And he says, I put the glass down and I came here. This is the last place I detoxed and quit drinking. And I couldn't fathom this guy's story. I was like... And he said, this is the hardest thing I ever did. And I heard that. Because this was the hardest thing I ever did. I knew I was going to die or I was going to pick up that next drink. And he said, I've done a lot of hard things. And he started telling me his story. He just started talking. He said, I was Special Forces in Vietnam, he says. And he used to go in and get POWs out. That was his job. He said, I've done a lot of stuff, hard stuff. And putting that glass down and coming here was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And you know what? I couldn't... This guy was talking to me, man. He had what I have. This guy was a world-class hero in every respect. And he was surrendering to what I had to surrender to. This guy showed me what surrendering was on a world-class scale, man. There was no question. And I have nothing but gratitude to that guy today. That was my Eskimo right there, man. That relieved me of the obsession to drink. It was one drunk talking to another. And a couple guys I knew from AA meetings in San Francisco, big guys, they came and got me, two big guys, Charlie and Austin, threw me in this little Volkswagen, you know, and I was shaking still, you know, and they said, we're going, this is, you know, after my 3 days in there, and I never saw this guy again, you know, after, but we hit the Golden Gate Bridge, and they got the sunroof open, and the wind's flapping, and they're like, I go, where are we going? They go, an AA meeting, ha ha, and they're laughing and noisy, and I'm like, God, okay, and whatever, because I'm going to any lengths, man. This guy gave it up. I'm giving it up. I gave it all up, and they brought me to you guys. And I tell you what, my life is great today. My life has been great every day since then, really. That guy talking to me, I mean, these steps, as soon as I surrendered, and I surrendered everything I might know, my best ideas got to go. My best thinking. I'm 30 years old, I'm in a detox, every idea I have that is cool and hip and together and really focused has got to go. And that's a scary place, man. It was scary to come in here. All the stuff you guys have taught me, it's so scary, all the principles, you know. Who's the coolest person in AA? Because that's who I want to talk to, you know. And you know the coolest person in AA? You know, I go, well, who's the most important person in AA? My spot, the most important person is the newest person. Well, who's the coolest person then? Because I want to get cool. You know, I don't need power then. And they said, well, the coolest person in AA is the first person to walk up to the newest person and put out their hand and say, how you doing? How's it going? That's all it takes. That's all it took to save my life, you know? My life has gotten so good, I got to work. I got to get my family back. My father was diagnosed with liver cancer when I came into you guys. He was given 6 months to live. And he had said, don't come home unless you're 6 months sober. And I knew he wasn't a mess around guy. And I just did what you guys did, you know. I told you guys about it. And I said, I'm freaked. I want to see my dad. And you guys told me what to do. Work these steps. Get your defects together, man. Write it down. Share it with somebody. Maybe there's some amends. I saw there was some hope and there was footwork to do, and I got to do it, and I got to go back. He waited, and I got to give my dad a 6-month chip. My 6-month chip, his 6-month chip. And he died like 2 days later. Yeah, and it was a spiritual awakening. All I've had are spiritual awakenings, you know. And you got to look for them, but they're all there. and I got to go back to work. I had a job. My first 6 months, I couldn't work. I finally got a job in a warehouse. I couldn't believe the check they gave me. I told my sponsor, look at the paycheck. I work in this warehouse and rode the bike. Look what they didn't pay me. I worked all week. They don't know who the hell I am. He'd say, well, maybe you're not being that much service to them. What do you mean, service to them? It's a warehouse. And I realized it's not about what I can make. It's not about the money I get. It's not about ripping you off. It's not about tricking a boss. It's about being of service. In the ultimate, if I'm of service and find the best service I can do, what do I do best? What can I give it to you? How can I give it to you? And I'll be reimbursed. I'll get more than I need back, plenty more than I need back. In relationships, if you don't want to do these steps, you don't have to, man. You don't have to. It's like you say, you can do anything in this program if you're willing to pay the price. I didn't do the steps. I did the steps up through 10, and then my sponsor left. He moved to Arizona, and I moved down here because, you know, I was working and getting a little successful. I was sort of meditating, not really, and being of service somewhat. But I got down here, I got down to L.A., and I got an apartment, you know, with a view of the thing there, and I was working on the road a lot, and a marble fireplace, and I got a white car to go with it, and it looked pretty good, and I had the clothes and the boots, and I looked good, and I really had a walk-in closet and mirrors, and it was all really nice, and shit, I looked good, and I... And I felt sort of empty. I just wasn't hitting a lot of meetings, but I knew I had a manager. I got a manager. I got like three agents. I got a publicist, and I really had no work. You know I couldn't afford them. There was nothing they were getting for me. It was just kind of like this company of guys I was trailing around, and I was getting nervous, and I hadn't really paid my IRS bill, you know. I mean, I'd made some financial amends to everybody but them, you know, because they aren't going away. They'll be there. And I was a little tense. I was getting a little tense. I was working a lot on the road to pay for the bills, to pay for the stuff that made me look good, because I was getting a lot. So I was shopping and working, and I was up in San Francisco, and that quake hit, and I was in a hotel, and I was like, duh, God's talking to me, man. And I married the next woman who called. And I did. The phone rang. I said, that's it. We're in the car. I got to come with this. You look good in the car. Let's go, you know. And I tricked her into marrying me, you know, and moved her down from Canada, you know. And it was like, God, what? I mean, it was like, we looked good, too. You put a little U2 in the tape deck and hit the coast. It was like, God, damn. This is love. And it lasted, you know, about 2 months. And I didn't know her. And she didn't know me. And I swear to you, I wasn't hitting a lot of meetings. But I'll tell you, when there was a point, I swear to God, I was holding up my new white sofa that I'd designed, holding up one end of it, and she had a knife. And I thought, I really got to get a sponsor. Get to some meetings, you know. And I did, you know. And it wasn't long after I was in L.A. I had to move her back. I got a sponsor, though. That got me, you know, I grabbed this guy. Please, you know, God. And Howard, thank God. Howard walked me through that. I had to make amends to her. Like, I am sorry, baby. Let me move you home. So I got her back home where she was safe and covered, you know, and her own government. And then I had this tax bill. I was like, it was the same day the riots were happening. I saw the fires coming towards my white apartment, man. And I was like, it was just the smoke getting bigger and bigger. I'm like, what am I going to do? And then I got the tax bill. It was like... Right around the same time, and I got this tax, so I'd never seen my name associated with such a huge figure before. because I'd spent all the money on the divorce, and they wanted their cut of that, you know. And it was like, ah! And I just packed the car. I figured, I'm moving to Mexico. I'm changing my name. She's going to Canada. I'm going to Mexico. And I just freaked. And I called my sponsor, and he said, Howard was the greatest. I said, I got problems, Howard. I got problems. He said, you know, Jesus had problems. I says, yeah. And Howard goes, I think he had really bad problems. I said, well, yeah, well, these are money problems, you know. He goes, well, you know, Jesus had problems. There were problems before that. Have you ever not had problems? I said, no, I've never not had problems. But these are pretty heavy. And he's like, well, you know what? He says, I've never had problems, or I've never not had problems, and I think I'll always have problems. And in this program, we get to walk through those problems. And it's how we do it, with some comfort. I said, but this is money, Howard. I am freaked. Listen to this figure, you know. Listen, it's the government. And he said, okay, he says, we're going to do a little exercise. He says, imagine you have just won the lottery. Okay, I've just won the lottery. He goes, I'm not kidding. You've won like $200 million. $200 million. You hit the lottery. You're at the window. You're giving them their ticket. They're giving you the first check. You have won. You got that feeling? I said, yeah, I got that feeling. He said, hang on to it because we're taking the money back. Hang on to that feeling. He said, that's how we get to live in AA. We get to be happy. You get to be free of fear. And I did. And I'll wrap this up because it's getting on that time. I got to pay that money back, you know. I realized I was living beyond my means. And I found sailing. A friend of mine in the program pointed to a sailboat and said, you know, you could live there. You don't need to live in that big place. I'm going to live on a boat. Are you kidding? Look at the size of that. Would be kind of cool. And and I did. I moved on to lower my standard, my cost of living. And I wound up paying the government. And I finished paying them off. I've been on that boat 4 years. I paid the government off in December. And I'm all caught up on my quarterlies for 97. And you go, what that? That's, I mean, it, that's, I just say that. It wasn't anything I did. It was what you guys taught me how to live and how to do. You know, and it can happen for you, too. I got credit cards now. I got a Sears card. I have everything today, man. I have everything today. I'm insured fully and medically in the vehicle. I have everything today, and it's all because of what you guys taught me. I know how to love today because I know what love is. Love is putting my wants aside and asking what I can do for you. Love is not looking good with a song playing in the background. Love is not what can you give me or you look good with me. I'm learning how to, I'm not good at practicing it all the time. You know? I'm learning. It's a process. I come and go, you know. I get that fear of commitment line coming at me. Yeah, well, I have that. But it's kind of a healthy fear a lot of times. But my life is great. Man, I have people who love me. My friend Sue came down. I got CJ. I got more people than I can tell you, you know. I got a million stories. I could talk all night, but I know that there's a whole thing too. I'll just do one more story. I was in Las Vegas over Thanksgiving. I was freaking out because I got this, it was a blessing. I got this performing thing at a casino there, opening for a big band, and I had this gig, and it was like the first time I've been able to open for somebody, and I was really excited because, see, they send a limo for you. They, like, put you in your room. They take care of everything. You're totally isolated. It's you and the limo driver. There's no other comedians around. You're just sort of by yourself. And it's Thanksgiving. I get in my room, and I got a view of the golf course, and it's deadly quiet. It's Thanksgiving. My family, I try and call them. Can't reach them on the phone. I'm freaking out. I do the show. My dressing room has a sauna, shower. Dressing room has a piano, wet bar. It's huge. Three rooms. There's nobody there. Huge fruit plate, totally alone. I'm freaking out. I do my show. I come off. It goes well. I'm all alone again. I got 24 hours to kill. I go back to where I call central office in Vegas. I go, man,
you guys got to help me. I am freaking out here. I am totally alone. They go, come down to the Riviera. You know, we might be able to help you. You know, come on down there. And I say, you got a nooner going on tomorrow? And they go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we got... I, okay, you know, 11:45, okay, I get down there, I walk in there having the Las Vegas roundup, there were 4,000 of you guys. I walked in, it was like I slap on a name tag, I'm hugging people I know, I ran into like 10 or 15 people I knew. People were hanging out, finally I had a dressing room full of friends, I had people, it's like, finally, somebody to share it with, because none of it means anything without somebody you love and somebody you can give it back to. And you guys have given me a life, and you can get one too if you stay here and work these steps and listen to what these people tell you. I love all of you, and thank you very much for my life.